You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi, and Hugo MacDonald.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Jane Kinnenmont, Senior Fellow at Chatham House.
We'll also look at the curious controversy of crosses on euro coins in Slovakia.
And in the preview of tonight's episode of The Menu, we'll meet Mr. Mutton from Black Sheep. That's the design agency that focuses on the hospitality industry.
I think the most important thing in doing anything within hospitality is you have to remember about the guest.
We'll find out how worried we really should be with predictions that the world's population will reach 10 billion by 2100. We'll speak to a geographer who has written a survival guide for the decades to come.
All that, plus we'll check in with our Balkans correspondent and we'll play some music too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Over a million people in Brazil have joined the latest round of mass protests across the country. The country's president, Dilma Rousseff, has halted a planned trip to Japan as the demonstrations continue. Security has been tightened in many towns and cities as public anger grows over corruption allegations and the cost of staging next year's Football World Cup. What began as a protest against public transport fares in Sao Paulo has spiraled across dozens of cities. Monocle's Sheena Rossiter is in Sao Paulo.
The rise in the bus fare is just basically the tip of the iceberg. Now people are protesting, you know, corruption, poor health care, poor education, and not to mention the high costs that are being spent on the World Cup, which is being funded by public money.
The smallest party in the Greek coalition, the Democratic Left, will today decide whether to leave the government after the collapse of talks aimed at finding ways to put Greece's state broadcaster ERT back on air. It was closed down by the government last week, with Prime Minister Antonis Samaras declaring that he intended to replace it with a cheaper, more efficient station. The leader of another coalition party, PASOK, says there's now an issue regarding the very existence of the government. It's not clear when planned talks between the US and the Taliban will go ahead. They'd been due to take place yesterday in Qatar, but were delayed after Afghanistan objected to what it sees as political recognition for the Taliban. Pakistan has revealed it facilitated the talks, saying it wants to secure a peaceful future for its neighbour. Thousands of refugees from the country have crossed the border. Not all of them want to return.
We don't have any plan to go back to Afghanistan because we want to live here in Pakistan because it's very difficult to live there. Lives are not easy there as troops are going.
I finish my university here, then I can go back to my country and help my people.
Britain and Argentina have again clashed over the Falkland Islands at an annual meeting of the UN Decolonisation Committee on the Falklands Malvinas dispute. Argentina's Foreign Minister Hector Timmerman called for London to engage in direct talks with Buenos Aires on the issue of sovereignty over the islands. The UK insisted the people of the islands need to be involved as well. The committee adopted its annual resolution calling for Britain and Argentina to resolve the dispute. In a referendum earlier this year, islanders voted almost unanimously in favour of remaining a British territory. Mike Summers, who's a member of the island's Legislative Assembly, says Argentina is simply not listening to them.
The problem largely is an Argentine problem that they want to discuss only with the UK and only on the question of sovereignty over and above the heads of the people of the Falkland Islands, which is a very colonial attitude.
A US Christian group that once promoted conversion therapy to encourage gays and lesbians to change their sexuality has closed its doors, acknowledging its mission had been hurtful and ignorant. Exodus International began operating in 1976. Its mission statement said it was mobilising the body of Christ to minister grace and truth to a world impacted by homosexuality. Now, at its 38th annual conference, the group's board has unanimously voted to cease operations and begin a separate ministry. Its president apologised for the pain caused by what he said had been a system of ignorance. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Barney Burnham. It's 17.05 in Sydney, 10.05 in Istanbul and 8.05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. It is time now to get ready and set the day's agenda. This is the part of the show where our experts choose the three big stories that we will need to know in the next 24 hours.
Well, joining us now for today's agenda setter is Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House and regular Monocle 24 contributor. Good morning, Jane. Thank you very much for joining us. And what is at the top of your agenda today?
Well, as ever, the dominant story in the Middle East these days is the Syria conflict and how that's evolving. And one of the latest twists in this is the Philippines saying that they may pull their peacekeepers out of the Golan Heights. All rather worrying. A couple of weeks ago, Syrian opposition fighters overran one of the US positions. And since then, you've begun to see, with the Austrians starting it, peacekeepers saying that now there's a war there, they'd quite like to go home.
And how many peacekeepers from Philippines are there in Golan Heights?
You're looking at a few hundred, similar to the Austrian deployment. The worry is that more will follow. If anything, there probably needs to be an increased deployment now that there's actual pressure on that border. And yet the indication is that there's a great deal of fear. The Philippines hasn't said it will definitely pull troops out, but they're saying that they need the UN to provide much more resources, heavier weaponry and so on.
And what has the UN come back and said that they will do to try and improve the situation there?
They are in a bind. I think they're saying that they're considering the request, but they certainly are under pressure. I mean, this is one of the most sensitive borders in the Middle East, and if it's not seen to be strongly protected, you're going to see more and more attacks on it.
How big a factor in this is all the stories, new stories we have heard of chemical weapons being used in Syria?
This is one of the primary concerns for the Israelis, but particularly they're concerned about whether chemical weapons might get outside Syria's borders and whether they may be being transferred to Hezbollah. Meanwhile, it's also been a political issue for the US because Obama said the use of chemical weapons before was a red line. And that seems to be what has prompted the US to say that they may formally start to arm the rebels, even though it's something that the White House doesn't seem to really desperately want to do.
And Jane, you mentioned the Austrians, of course, have withdrawn their peacekeeping troops. Are there any replacements in the wings for, well, the Austrians now, but if the Philippines do withdraw?
No, this is a major problem. There's very little appetite to get involved in any way. It's risky and it's a conflict where the public in most countries is confused, doesn't know what side to be on. So while the Syrian government is conjuring up fears that the West is desperate to intervene and send troops, there's very little appetite from any countries to put their people in the potential line of fire.
So in the worst case scenario, if the Philippines forces are indeed to leave Golan Heights, how well can the remaining forces actually function and work there anymore?
It really depends whether others follow, and it depends on the intensity of attacks that come. But I think the worrying alternative scenario is that if Israel thinks that there are very few options for defending the border, they might become tempted to be more involved themselves, as they became in Lebanon when that country had its civil war.
Well, Jane, let's shift our gaze a little further east to Kuwait, where there's news of a snap election being called on the 25th of July. Tell us a bit about this story.
Well, one of the continued underlying issues in the Middle East is the deficit of democracy that this part of the world has. And Kuwait is unusual among the rich Gulf monarchies in that it has got quite a strong parliament, but it's only strong up to a point. They can overrule the emir. They speak very freely about anything that they want. But when the emir thinks that there is an impasse and a stalemate, he does have the constitutional right simply to dissolve the parliament and call new elections. And since he came in 7 years ago, he's done that four times. More recently, Parliament's been dissolved by a court, and that's what's happened now. It's essentially been over a technicality about the way in which an election committee was formed. But it's very undermining to the status of democracy there. The last election was on the 1st of December, and increasingly Kuwaitis are getting fed up with voting, especially when they know that MPs probably won't be there for more than a year.
Exactly. I was just about to ask how people feel about that. The parliament has got dissolved basically pretty much once a year, altogether six times since 2006. Mm. That must be incredibly frustrating.
It has a big impact on the way that MPs behave. The MPs tend to be criticised for being obstructive, for not paying much attention to the country's economic development, which lags behind that of Dubai, which conspicuously has no elected representation at all. But that's also rational from the point of view of MPs. If you think your parliamentary career is likely to last only a year, then what you want to do is make yourself known, make noise, and try to get a bigger cut of public spending for your constituents. So it is a systemic problem, but it's one where it's very convenient for leaders in places like Dubai or Saudi Arabia to point to this and say, see, we just can't have democracy in our part of the world.
Mm, exactly. So it's such a wider instability, not just in Kuwait, but in the rest of the Gulf states as well.
Absolutely.
That's not recognised in Kuwait by the emir too? That actually he's doing something to sort of undermine himself?
What the emir thinks about this isn't very clear. I mean, certainly he's moved from a position where he has been dissolving parliament to this current state where it's been done by the court. And he basically accuses MPs and opposition activists who are obstructive of being voices of chaos. So it's very much trying to put the blame on the opposition, who are not only wanting to be in parliament, but are also pushing for more democracy. They've been calling for having a more elected government, which currently doesn't happen. Currently, it's the emir who appoints all the ministers, often from his own family.
How would you describe the relationship the leader of Kuwait, leadership of Kuwait, basically has in relation to democracy? They say that they have the strongest parliament in the Gulf, but is that a source of pride?
It used to be. Back in the 60s and 70s, when Kuwait was the first Gulf country to become independent of British colonial rule, and it was seen as a leader economically, educationally, scientifically, it was like the Qatar of the 60s, 70s and 80s. But ever since the invasion and occupation of Iraq, it's never quite recovered that leadership position. Sorry, by Iraq, not of Iraq. It's never quite recovered that leadership role that it used to have.
Jane, let's talk leadership elsewhere in the Middle East. And Rami Hamdallah, the Palestinian Prime Minister, resigned after just 2 weeks. Tell us a bit about the background to this.
Well, it highlights really the ongoing lack of inspiring leadership in the Palestinian political system. For the past several years, the Prime Minister was Salam Fayyad, who was someone who was very well liked by the West, former World Bank economist, importantly seen as someone who was fighting corruption. But he wasn't someone particularly popular on the streets. He resigned, seemingly in frustration at a power struggle with the president. And 2 weeks ago, they appointed a new Prime Minister, again meant to be an independent, a technocrat. He had been the head of An-Najah, which is one of the big West Bank universities in Nablus. But only 2 weeks later, he submitted his resignation. It's not clear whether he will go or whether this is part of a political bargaining, but it does highlight these very deep internal problems where leadership is desperately needed, but just doesn't seem to be forthcoming. They haven't had elections there since 2006, when, in the eyes of the West, certainly the wrong party won. And there seems to be international support for perpetually postponing new elections.
So basically, there's been a prime minister for 2 weeks. Obviously, everything hasn't gone quite according to the plan if we have the prime minister resigning so soon. What went wrong exactly?
The Palestinian president is increasingly criticised for being autocratic, for trying to stay in control. And that's one of the reasons why he hasn't wanted to have fresh elections. He is pretty pro-Western, seen as pro the peace process. So internationally, there is no pressure for Palestinian elections. But it seems that his desire to keep control has been something that's really frustrated the new prime minister, who's come into politics for the first time and found that he can't really do very much.
And what sort of reaction has this had in, the Palestinian people? Do they feel a little bit frustrated on his behalf as well? Or are they very much behind him as a figurehead?
He's not a political leader. He's been respected as an academic, but there's a real split between the people and the political leadership. And worryingly, one of the things that you see in the West Bank is Hamas are growing more and more popular.
Well, Jane Kinnamont, Senior Research Fellow at Chatham House, thank you very much for coming in and setting today's agenda.
You're listening to Monocle 24. It's just 15 minutes past the top of the hour. Here on Monocle 24, we continue very soon with some thoughts on how restaurants and bars should be designed.
Monocle 24 continues its global summer tour with a stop-off in Thailand. Next week, we'll be touching down in Bangkok for two very special editions of The Briefing. On Wednesday and Thursday next week, The Briefing will be coming live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre, presented by Monocle's Editor-in-Chief, Tyler Brulé, and Editor Andrew Tuck. We'll be bringing you a snappy roundup of the current state of affairs in Thailand's creative scene and meet the people making waves in Bangkok's thriving design community. So tune into The Briefing at midday UK time and 1800 in Thailand on Wednesday and Thursday next week, live from the Thailand Creative and Design Centre in Bangkok, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 15:16 in Singapore and 8:16 here in London. You're listening to Midori House with me, Hugo MacDonald, and Marcus Hippie, and it's time now for a preview of this week's episode of The Menu.
Exciting. I've been quite busy with the programme, actually, Hugo.
Yeah. What have you got in store for us, Marcus?
Well, on this week's edition of our food and drink show, The Menu, indeed, I for example, spoke with Tim Mutton. He founded design agency Black Sheep 10 years ago, and from the beginning, the company has kept hospitality industries in its focus. Mutton's team has been thinking about how to create the feeling of luxury in a club, bar or a restaurant.
Well, here's a snippet of Tim Mutton's conversation with Marcus, and he tells him about the lessons he's learnt along the way.
I was a terrible flunky at school. I ended up working in bars and restaurants, and I was very fortunate. I think probably the most memorable hospitality experience for me going way back was my uncle worked for Four Seasons. I was walking into the Pierre in Four Seasons in New York. And I guess from that moment, I just felt hospitality was and had to be my world.
And it's already over 10 years since you launched Black Sheep. When it comes to hospitality design, designing restaurants, bars, hotels even, has anything changed during those years?
Yes, it's got a lot more demanding. And the world of hospitality, I mean, it's an immense industry. And you find that now, because of global travel, people's expectations of hospitality these days are foremost. You just look at what's happening on the internet and just how people rate bars, clubs and restaurants through satisfaction ratings. And even when you're looking at that as a designer, there's a certain level of pressure there that you have to create something that is liked and successful.
What do you think you have learned yourself during all these years?
Oh, many things. Many, many, many things. I think the most important thing in doing anything within hospitality is you have to remember about the guest. And at Black Sheep, our culture is very much about that. We don't like calling clients clients. We call everybody guests. And it's at the foremost of any form of design thinking that we do. Design, it has to be, for us, it has to be a measurable thing. You can design the most beautiful bar in the world, but unless you can get served well and you get served with a smile, for us, that's a really important aspect of how we create partnerships with the brands and the guests that we work with.
Is there a time when the relationship between you and, well, customer or the guest, as you say, ends, considering that when you have designed a place, it obviously is there for years? Are you at any point thinking that, you know, it's done?
No, I don't believe it should be. I think the one thing I've learned from certainly having Black Sheep over the last 10 years is that relationships are really important and they have to go, you know, really deep, especially with a lot of the guests and the brands that we work with. So finishing a job and taking your fee and never returning is really, it's not the thing to do. The thing to do is retain the relationship and give opinion, constructive or non-constructive, I think it's really one of the most important things to do. I mean, it's strange. We've done projects and I've returned and the design sometimes may need a tweak. We've done really majorly successful nightclubs and sometimes had to change some of the what we feel the highest value seating areas within a club just because the traffic areas just changed over 3 months or 6 months. It's really important that, like with any business, to hit and make a smash of it day one, that's great. But you know what? You always got to keep improving things.
Can you give me examples, other examples of what have you been changing, what these adjustments have been?
The example I can best think of is 8 years ago, one of our very first sort of notable projects in London was the Cuckoo Club in Mayfair. And I remember sitting down with the owners, just looking at the plan for the club prior to sort of launch. And we were looking at where we felt all the high spending tables would be. And so we sort of designated them and sort of felt, really, we need to give a certain level of onus to those. And actually, about a month after opening, actually one of the tables closest to the door was actually the highest spending table. And the reason for that was it was the area where they could see people coming and going and where they were most seen. And we just felt, because of it being a high traffic area, that nobody would want to sit there. But actually, it was the most desirable seat in the house.
I started thinking when you mentioned that example that, you know, the table was most spending because people wanted to see who was coming in and they wanted to be seen. What have you learned of human psychology when designing restaurants?
Oh, I'm just a simple designer. but I guess that, you know, really, that people, it has to be enjoyable. You know, you have to have a certain level of uplift. You know, what I do love, in particular what we're doing at the moment, is that you have a lot of brands, a lot of spaces where you're having to get the day parts really right because rents are very expensive. So if you go from something which is, you know, open in the morning right through to late at night, how can you best cater for those that might come in the morning but also want to return late at night and get the behavioral differences between morning and late at night? I mean, that's what we call having to sweat, you know, the equity of the business really quite hard, because the pressures certainly within hospitality are very hard at the moment, in particular sort of rising food costs, wage costs. So I always say the important aspect, really most important aspect of what we do, is getting the repeatable experience. Without the repeatable experience, it's the return of customer. So forget ROI, look at the return of the customer. So yes, of course, within design, we are playing all relative to the type of work we're doing. If it's a, like we're working on a bakery, a new concept bakery in Dubai at the moment, and it's a very sort of female-friendly form of brand. So again, how do we cater for that? And what do we do in relation to designing it, either from the packaging or the website, or in relation to the interior, to make that a very pleasantable experience?
You're often dealing with luxury. Many of your customers want to be, you know, classified as luxurious places. Say, when it comes to restaurants, how do you take the idea of luxury beyond food?
Very much, again, based on the experience. If you're looking, I mean, and again, luxury has changed in the world. So if you're looking at new luxury, but if you're looking at how luxury has been defined, where you're spending, you know, over £250 a head plus, of course you want space, you want comfort, you want time at your table. And, you know, importantly as well, in relation to design, really supporting the elements of service. So service is really, really important, and that one-to-one level of service and the efficiency of service and service being really graceful. It's a very hidden thing and a beautiful thing. It's kind of poetry within restaurants, and I think, you know, working within that genre, I love it. And it's just looking at, again, anything that we do is looking at the back of house in relation to the front of house and how you can perfect that to make sure that it becomes a luxurious experience in relation to how that particular restaurant works.
That was Tim Mutton of Black Sheep, a design agency specializing in the hospitality industry. And you can hear the full interview and obviously so much more on restaurants and cuisine around the globe on today's brand new edition of The Menu at 1900 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this with a chat about a controversy with coins.
A harp, a tree, an eagle, cloudberries, a double cross, the Pope, and countless monarchs. A rather peculiar collection of cultural symbols, one of which has been the centre of controversy. Late last year, a disagreement unfolded between the EU Commission and the National Bank of Slovakia after the Slovaks were ordered to remove halos and crosses from special commemorative euro coins due to be minted this summer.
The religious symbols were apparently in breach of European diversity rules that ban any tilt toward a single faith. Despite this, Slovakia's National Bank has decided to stick with its original coin design and abandon plans for a halo-free minting in honour of two Christian missionaries, Cyril and Methodius. This spat has triggered a wider debate regarding the use of religious symbols as a display of national identity, and also leads us to wonder why the Vatican's euro coins are adorned with images of the Pope. Joining us now in the studio to discuss this further is Thomas Hockenhull, curator of modern money at the British Museum. Welcome to the show, Thomas. Thank
Good morning.
Very much for coming in. So let's start with this case in Slovakia. I'm looking at the pictures of the euro coin in question. And I mean, it doesn't to me look too offensive.
It's interesting. It incorporates the double cross, which is used on the euro coin anyway, on the euro reverse. The double cross, which is also on the Slovakian flag, it's a political symbol, and yet it's also a Christian symbol. It has a double, you know, double use, as it were. I think that in some ways the two characters that feature on the other side of the coin, Constantine Cyril, his full name is known, and Methodius, two brothers from Greece, who went up into Slovakia as Christian missionaries. I think. Perhaps using those as images on the coins is also maybe a double meaning as well, because they weren't just Christian missionaries. They were, in a way, far more important than that. And perhaps it's the National Bank of Slovakia's mistake to suggest that they were just Christian missionaries, because they're far more important. Constantine Cyril, invented an alphabet to which the Slovakian, well, the Slavic language could be written down, hence Cyrillic. The alphabet.
Can you explain us a bit this European Union's attitude towards religious symbols? Why don't they want this in coins?
It's quite curious. I don't know their meaning. I guess it's to promote some kind of de facto political unity for Europe, and to present something that's pan-European. Therefore, to promote just one religion contravenes that. So that's the only thing that I can think of. But as you brought up, the Vatican has coins. It issues euros, and on the reverse of the Vatican euro is the head of the Pope.
One rule for one, and one for another.
And it's interesting because, of course, the Pope is the head of state, but he's also head of Catholic Church, and that really promotes such a conflict. And it really, I think, highlights the problem with trying to create a euro series that is at once inclusive and promotes political unity, but at the same time is trying to present symbols of nationality, of cultural independence. You know, you've got European states, which for one reason or another have been at war with each other for centuries, and then in a time of peace you have a de facto monetary union, and trying to use symbolism to somehow marry those two disparate forces together is slightly problematic.
Indeed, I mean, monarchies presumably have it easier because putting the king or the queen on the coin is not seen as offensive in any way.
Yeah, as head of state, sovereign. Of course, I mean, the queen is head of the Church of England.
Yeah.
So if the euro were to extend to the UK, then there may be a slight question mark over that. Probably not with the Vatican having head of state and head of church. Some countries choose to make things easier for themselves. Estonia has probably the most imaginative reverses, featuring as it does the map of Estonia.
you can't go too wrong with
those fascinating designs.
I know my home country's got cloudberries, and I'm always wondering why the berries won over wolves and bears we have in Finland.
The national symbol, yeah. I don't know. I mean, if you look at one of the more interesting currencies is that of Croatia, which introduced a currency only 20 years ago. And it actually has a little pine martin, but it's actually the pine martin is the name of the currency. And the reason being that pine martin pelts were once used to trade
as a currency.
And they're used as a currency.
Fascinating. That's a great pub quiz, bit of knowledge.
It'd be a very niche pub quiz.
Indeed. I want to ask a little bit about your job at the British Museum. You're curator of modern money.
That's correct, yeah.
What does that involve exactly then?
Well, Department of coins and medals at the British Museum, holds the national collection, the National Numismatic Collection, which is about 1 million objects in total. So I look after the modern end of the collection, which is pretty much everything after about 1700. So it's about 180,000 objects, and it encompasses a really broad range of objects. So I look after banknotes, I look after coins, I look after credit cards, I look after checks, I look after tokens, I look after bus passes, I look after all these different objects which contribute to a history of financial transaction across the world.
Absolutely fascinating. That was Tom Hockenhull, curator of modern money at the British Museum. Thank you very much for visiting Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the programme, we find out which lessons are crucial in surviving the huge increase in the world's population over the next few decades. We'll get the latest discussion topics from Zagreb, from our man in the Balkans, and we'll also leaf through the day's Italian papers too.
But first, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Over 1 million people in Brazil have joined the latest round of mass protests across the country. President Dilma Rousseff has halted a planned trip to Japan as the demonstrations continue. The smallest party in the Greek coalition, the Democratic Left, will today decide whether to leave the government after the collapse of talks aimed at finding ways to put the state broadcaster ERT back on air. It's still not clear when planned talks between the US and the Taliban will go ahead after Afghanistan objected to what it sees as political recognition for the Taliban. Pakistan has revealed it facilitated the talks, saying it wants to secure a peaceful future for its neighbour. Britain and Argentina have again clashed over the Falkland Islands at an annual meeting of the UN Decolonisation Committee on the Falklands Malvinas dispute. The committee adopted its annual resolution calling for Britain and Argentina to resolve the dispute. A US Christian group that once promoted conversion therapy to encourage gays and lesbians to change their sexuality has closed its doors, acknowledging that its mission had been hurtful and ignorant. Exodus International's president apologised for the pain it had caused by what he said had been a system of ignorance. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, global human population has experienced steady growth since the end of the 14th century. There are currently over 7 billion of us, and according to the UN's top demographics experts, we will be as many as 10.1 billion by 2100.
Well, this is something we have to get prepared for so that we know how to deal with the scarcity of resources. And in his book, Population 10 Billion, The Coming Demographics Crisis and How We Survive It, geographer Danny Dorling has mapped out a guide to the decades to follow. Danny Dorling joins us now in studio to discuss his book. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
How fundamentally will an almost 50% rise in the world's population change our lives in the future?
We're going to get more crowded. It's not just that population's going up, it's that it's actually going down in rural parts of the world. So it's going up even more in cities. So we're going to become an urban creature. Already half of us live in cities. That's going to become the large majority of us, and these cities are going to be different kinds of cities to the ones we've been used to.
And Danny, I mean, we speak about this a lot on Monocle 24, the urbanisation in general, but also so the ageing populations.
Yes.
And it seems that obviously population growth is happening more in developing countries rather than first world countries, which are facing something at the other end of the scale of people just living longer.
Yes.
But what is the cause for such a gigantic expansion?
Well, people are also beginning to live longer in countries, in the middle-ranking countries. And in a way, we always talk about ageing. We never talk about how we're just getting less young people, you know, which is what we need to get if we're going to stop at around about 10 billion, 11 billion. The cause of the expansion, it all began, as you say, it began in the 14th century. It was quite slow. It took off around about 1851. And from 1851 to 1971, we had a population explosion, like an algae bloom of human beings. Since 1971, it's slowed down. I think what made it all start in 1851 was trade and capitalism distorting traditional systems whereby people controlled their fertility. And capitalism and population growth went hand in hand. They've got the same geography and the same history. And when you have more and more young people, you can always make money as a capitalist. You can sell more because your market's always getting bigger. That then disrupts traditional societies and you get more population growth. The really interesting thing is to ask, why did the rate of growth slow down after 1971? And it's good, we're going to be approaching a plateau, but the traditional way of making money out of more and more people isn't going to work in future because there aren't going to be more and more young people. So that market in particular is shrinking.
Danny, you just said that in the future, ever more people are going to be living in the cities, and as a result, the cities are going to be different from what we know. What are they going to be like?
Well, we have to look to Asian cities, I think, to see the best guides. You have to look at Shanghai and Hong Kong and so on to see cities which are quite crowded but quite organised. Tokyo, of course, is a brilliant example of one of the most livable, very large cities in the world. One thing about these cities is that they have an average approaching one child per couple. So, which, you know, it's halving. So these are going to be cities where people come into all the time, which of course is traditionally what a city is, but at a kind of higher rate. We're probably going to see greater rates of immigration and moving around than we've been used to worldwide, because those parts of the world which are ageing the most are going to need more young people. Other parts of the world have more young people. They don't want to lose all their young people, but they can afford to lose some. But getting our mindset in places like Tokyo or London or Paris or Berlin to the idea that actually we shouldn't be putting these walls up quite so tightly as we age, that's going to be tricky to do.
People generally talk about, so rather than the 10 billion sort of phenomenon as something to be scared of, but actually your book offers quite an optimistic approach. Yeah. Maybe tell us how you've arrived at that and explain why actually it's not something to be so scared of. Maybe.
The optimism is because of this slowdown, because as I said, in 1971 we put on the brakes. We're still going forward, but we put on the brakes. We hit peak baby in 1990, the highest number of babies ever born in a year worldwide. We're probably never going to have as many babies again. I think we've hit about peak 18-year-old now. So my reason for not being scared of population growth is that population growth is ending, and it's ending largely voluntarily. Most of the reason is people making their own decisions to have fewer children. There are a huge number of global problems left. In the book, I list 42 things to worry about that are more important than population growth. I do think it's possible that our grandchildren could have a better life than we have, but a better life might not be a more greedy life.
But anyhow, it seems that we are going to be about 3 billion more after the following 90 years or so. What is the most essential thing, or two most essential things that we should concentrate on in order to survive this population explosion?
For the population to be stable, the population of the world needs to be happier. When people are happier, they had fewer babies. To be happier, you need to look at global inequalities in income and wealth. If we carry on with the levels of inequalities in income and wealth we have globally now, we can't hope to stop at 10 billion and things look much worse. That's the first one. The second one is our carbon emissions. We are going to have to bring them down, and the people who have to bring them down most are the people who are emitting most. Otherwise, other people will try to copy them because it becomes a lifestyle to emulate. And if the lifestyle of those who are polluting the most is emulated, again, we have a massive problem. But these are not insurmountable problems. If you look 100 years ago in where we are now in London, London, you might have said, was surrounded with horses. It was absolutely full of horses. And you might have said, oh, people in the rest of the world, they're all going to want to have hansom cabs. They're all going to want to be taken around by horses, and the world will fill up with what horses produce. Now, that didn't happen. Similarly, the way that our big cities at the moment, some of them are dominated by cars, I can't see them being dominated by cars in 100 years' time. Cars are a very inefficient, old, dirty, dangerous technology. But as long as we get ourselves out of cars and, say, back onto bikes. So it's not about new technologies, it's just about doing things in a cleverer way.
I love your optimism.
You also, in this book, you're also emphasising, besides concentrating on the population explosion, you're also looking what happens after that. We should also start thinking about what happens when the population has reached its top and when the population will go into decline.
Yes, and starts to shrink. I mean, we don't have many models of this. After the Black Death is one of these examples. You certainly no longer have a housing problem. But also the value of young people rises dramatically. The value of labourers after the Black Death rose. And we should be thinking about about this period, because this is the period we're actually heading to. This is a UN medium variant projection. And it alters all kinds of things you plan. For instance, I work in a university. Universities have for decades been operating under the idea that we're going to get more people next year than the year before. So we've got to chuck these 18, 19 and 21-year-olds out quickly to make space for the next ones. We don't have to do that in future because there'll be fewer younger children coming in. We don't need to crowd so much education into those early years of life, which, to be honest, I think is a bit too concentrated. So learning could be spread much more over our longer lives in future. Whereas I can see why we do it the way we do it now, but we do it the way we do it now because we've been going through this population explosion and that's coming to an end.
That sounds like a fundamental way we need to change our ways of thinking. And that what you said, it almost makes me think that this is a positive problem. But yeah. What is the worst thing about that when population starts going into decline?
There can be bad things. I mean, another example of a place which, in fact, the only island on the planet which went into decline is Ireland. Ireland has never got back to its population it had in 1840. There's almost nowhere else you can find like this. And losing a sense of things are going downwards is difficult to cope with. Parts of Eastern Europe more recently have had decline. If it's not dealt with well, you can get a sense of depression. You can get a sense of underused utilities, the sewer systems, the roads and so on aren't used. And this is partly why I say we need to open up to the idea of spreading people around a bit better so that we don't suddenly see our great big cities in the first world becoming less and less used and a bit soulless as places. If you want to go really far forward, what happens if it becomes normal, as it is now in Barcelona and Shanghai, to have one child per couple worldwide? How would we cope in 150 years, 200 years, with population halving every generation? But that's a long way away.
Luckily, we still have a few years to figure out the answers to those questions. Yeah. That was Danny Darling, author of Population 10 Billion. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We continue with a check-in with our man in the Balkans after this short break. Stay tuned.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
For Monocle, in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keep you an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is 8:43 here in London and 9:43 in Zagreb, which is where we head now to speak with our man in the Balkans, Guy Delaunay, who's there. Thank you very much for joining us, Guy. And imagining there's quite a lot of excitement in Croatia at the moment about the impending EU accession, which happens in a week.
Yeah, that's right. It is just over a week's time. And on July the 1st, Croatia becomes the 28th member state of the European Union. But the funny thing is, I'm sitting right now smack in the middle of the main square of Zagreb, Josip Jelačića Square, where all the trams are coming through, people cycling past, people walking by in their summer clothes because it's roasting hot here. And you wouldn't particularly know that they were about to join the European Union. You'd have thought that maybe there'd be a lot of the blue flags with the 12 stars on them hanging about the place. We haven't got much of that at the moment. And as I've been going around talking to people over the past couple of days in Zagreb, I think people are approaching it in a fairly matter-of-fact way, to be honest with you, although that may, of course, change as we approach the big day.
Does that all indicate a lack of enthusiasm for membership?
Well, you know, people, when you ask them this, when I was talking to the ambassador for the European Union, I said, well, the enthusiasm level doesn't appear to be particularly high. We had the first ever Euro MP elections in Croatia in May, and only one in five people bothered to vote. And people are a little bit defensive about that. And they say, well, there wasn't a proper campaign. The mandate's only for a year before we do the full elections next year. And if you look at the polls, the support for EU membership is still about 60, 65%. So, no, of course the enthusiasm levels haven't gone down. But then I was speaking to another person yesterday who organizes music festivals on the coast of Croatia, and she said, well, one of my friends said, we've been waiting so long for this membership because the process has been extremely long. I don't care anymore. It's so much become part of the furniture of people's life, this run-up to European Union membership, that by the time they've actually got there, the fatigue has already set in.
Oh, don't. But will the day itself still be a big day for celebration, do you get the impression?
Yes, yeah, so they are preparing lots of things. And in the square, they have just been taking down a couple of displays which were all about joining the European Union. Rather, slightly paradoxically, they had a display of Croatian goods, which I think was meant to display what Croatia would bring to the European Union, not just a debt rating, which is a junk status at the moment, which is the joke that a lot of people have been making. And also they've got they're going to have on the big day in this square concerts for the dignitaries from around Europe coming. People are, believe it or not, extremely excited about the arrival of Angela Merkel, so much so that they're closing the balconies around the square so that there's no security risk. But it's going to be a bit like a New Year's Eve party, really. The accession's on the 1st of July, but the party is on the 30th. And on the stroke of midnight, Croatia turns into an EU member.
And I have to say now, by the way, that we'll be hearing lots more from Croatia on Monocle 24 next week, previewing the European Union membership. We actually have a story on Croatia on every episode of The Globalist next week. Guy, let's continue with Bosnia protests. There's been protests over there for weeks. What are they all about?
Well, on the face of it, it's about a lack of ID numbers. And this is, would seem to some people to be a rather strange thing to be protesting about. Some of them are saying, well, in the UK, people protest against ID cards, but here they are in Bosnia protesting about the lack of them. But what happened was the law which allowed the issuing of ID numbers lapsed in February, and the Parliament hasn't been able to agree on a replacement. What that means is that since February, anybody being born after the expiry of that law hasn't been issued with an ID number, and this can cause all sorts of problems for them in their lives. They don't get a national health insurance, for example. They won't be able to get a passport. And people are just really very fed up about this, not just because of the ID issue, but really it highlights what a terrible mess Bosnia's government is in. It doesn't seem to be able to make any meaningful decisions. The parliamentarians make about six times the average national salary, but they can't make a decision which affects the welfare of everybody who lives in that country.
And of course, there's sort of ethnic divides in Bosnia. Are people being drawn together across these in protest?
Yes, they have. This is one of the really interesting things. It's terribly hard to cut across the ethnic divide in Bosnia. You've got Croats, Bosniak Muslims, and ethnic Serbs, and usually never angel meet, but certainly have been outside the parliament building. They formed a human chain around the parliament building at one point, thousands of protesters, including many mothers with their children in pushchairs, and they blockaded the parliament and wouldn't allow the lawmakers out. And I think the only reason they actually got out on that occasion was because there was a foreign delegation in there which had been talking about investment in Bosnia, and they took pity on the foreigners. They'd been tweeting from the inside that they didn't have any food or drink, and that they were getting rather hungry and thirsty, so the protesters relented and let them out. Otherwise, I think they would have been quite happy to keep the MPs in there as long as it would have taken. And I think everybody recognises that this ethnically divided model of government isn't working for them anymore. You have a Croat-Bosniak federation, you have the Republika Srpska with the ethnic Serbs, and the parliament in the middle, which is meant to ratify everything for everybody. But it doesn't work. The international community is there in absolute droves of consultants and organizations, and they're not helping particularly either. People's daily lives are not working, and they're very angry about it.
That was Guy Delaunay, our man in the Balkans. You are listening to Midori House.
And we'll be having a rifle through the Italian newspapers in just a moment. But first, let's have a song. And this is from your homeland, Marcus.
Should I introduce it?
Yeah, go on then.
This is Jenni Vartiainen, actually one of my ex-neighbours almost, from where I come in Finland. This is En halua kuolla tänä yönä. Jenni Vartiainen there from Finland with En halua kuolla tänä yönä. It's 15:53 in Hong Kong, 8:53 in London. You are listening to Midori House. With me, Marco Sippi.
And Hugo MacDonald. Hugo MacDonald. And it's time now to review this morning's front pages. Today with an Italian twist. We're joined by David Pleasant, Monocle's researcher. David, thank you for coming in.
Hello, clutching Hugo.
A well-thumbed...
La Repubblica.
Exactly.
Here. Yeah. So La Repubblica and all the papers are leading with, they're calling it the Fed effect. So the Federal Reserve announced in the United States announced that they are going to stop their quantitative easing program. This has led to a big fall across Europe, especially in Italy, somewhere very susceptible to such announcements. 230 billion euros lost with that announcement. So that's pretty serious economic news. It's taking up perhaps four or five of the first pages of La Repubblica. But then slightly better news. Letta, the newish prime minister, he seems to have got the seal of approval from the Chamber of Deputies, the Parliament. He's pushing through some new measures. There's pictures of him beaming, a big smile. He seems to be doing pretty well.
Mm. And you were in Sicily recently. I think you're going to Sicily again very shortly. Do you manage to get a sense that people are really in support of him and sort of have quite a lot of optimism attached to him?
Well, I think so, yes. Generally, the stories coming out of the papers are good news ones. You know, people seem to be giving him a chance, that they're not really digging in with the daggers that we've seen in the past with the kind of toing and froing with the political infighting. I think people are open to some of his proposals, some of his tax incentives, some of his investments in kind of programs for the young and so on. So I think there is a slightly newer mood, certainly in the press and amongst Italians in general.
And now another news topic from Italy. People are discussing their relationship with Islam.
Exactly. Last week, it was found out that an Italian Muslim named Giuliano Ibrahim Del Nervo was killed in Syria. He was with a jihadist fighting faction there. And this was really quite shocking news in Italy and was reported very widely. Italy, I think, generally has had quite a relaxed attitude to its Muslim population, which is fairly considerable, numbering some million people. But there seems to be a bit of a turnaround. La Stampa from Turin has this story that an Israeli expert, defense expert, says that Italy is a soft target for extremist activity. Slightly strange way of starting. It says that you could pop in to get a falafel and you come out a fundamentalist, talking about some of Rome's Islamic or Muslim eateries. So that's one story.
You've got another story about employment and a rather perhaps surprising employee that's coming out on top. As what is it exactly? The most?
Yeah. So there's been Universum, which is Italy's most attractive employers ranking, has come out. The ranking came out yesterday, and quite surprisingly, Ferrero, a chocolate manufacturer, has come out on top as Italy's most attractive employer, overtaking Google, that was a previous winner, and also a whole host of other multinationals like Ernst & Young and others that traditionally have been the most aspired employers in Italy. And it's actually the top few on the list are, in fact, Italian firms, including Ferrari, Pirelli, Eni, the big oil, petrochemicals manufacturer, and Luxottica. So,
is this not just because Italians love chocolate, but do you think they're seeing a return to wanting to work for homegrown brands?
I think so. And that's what this piece in the La Corriere della Sera seems to be concluding, that they're looking for kind of strong, stable presence within their working life, and that they see within some of these brands that are managing to do very well despite the economic climate.
Well, that's all we have time for today, I'm afraid, David.
Thank you to our producers, Barbara Feeney and Annabel Bly, our researcher, Fernando August Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. Hugo, you are staying here in this Midori House Studio One. It's time for Section D with Hugo, straight after the news headlines. Next Monday's edition of Midori House will be broadcast live from Milan, where Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé will be presenting with Phil Hahn at Milan Men's Fashion Week. But from me, Markus Hippi.
And me, Hugo MacDonald.
It's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.